Next second point is demonstrating that you will not become a Buddha by learning either method of wisdom separately. It's not enough just to want to attain Buddhahood, you must engage in the method of achieving it. This method has to be unmistaken, because no matter how much you strive on a mistaken path, you will not obtain the result, like milking a horn in the hope of getting milk. Even if the method is unmistaken, if it is not complete in all particulars, striving will not bring the result, just as the absence of a seed, water, earth or the like will preclude the production of a sprout. What then is the unmistaken and complete set of causes and condition? In regard to this, I have already explained compassion. The great trailblazer Kamala Shila explains that the spirit of enlightenment is both the conventional and ultimate spirits of enlightenment, and that method is all virtues such as generosity and so forth. Opponent's position. Some persons, like the Chinese Huashang, have a mistaken idea about the path of the two types of spirit of enlightenment, and say that any thought, non-virtuous thoughts, of course, but even virtuous ones, binds us to cycle existence, so its results do not transcend cycle existence. It is like being tied up with a golden rope or with an ordinary rope, like white or dark clouds covering the sky, or like the pain from being bitten by a white or a black dog. Therefore, just setting your mind in a state that lacks any thought is the path of future Buddhahood. So here it is important to know that when we talk about Huashang as the opponent, do not think that all the Chinese Huashang masters have such a wrong view, but it refers to one particular lineage of Huashang. As I said, that in Samye Monastery, there were this special place for the translators, for the meditators and so on. And then there is also a place for the tantric practitioners, mantric practitioners, who wear the white robes. And so in this place of unmoving meditators, unmoving meditation, whose main task is to engage in one-pointed meditation and who specialize in one-pointed meditation. So if all the Huashangs were wrong and mistaken, then they should all have been refuted right at the time of the about Shantarakshita, but this was not done. So whatever kind of history you read, it is important to understand various versions in their proper context. And so in the case of some of the good Huashang practitioners, they would engage in a practice which is a harmonious blend of hearing, thinking and meditation, but would primarily focus on one-pointed meditation. So that kind of line of practice is fine. But then there are other lineage of Huashang practice, where as is explained in this text, who would say that one-pointed meditation means to try to maintain a kind of blankness of mind, not to focus either on virtuous points or non-virtuous points. And he gives the example saying that doesn't matter whether the sun is covered by black cloud or white cloud. So similarly, make sure that your mind is not obscured by any kind of thoughts. So it is this kind of wrong Huashang thought which is being refuted here and by Kamala Shila. Between the seven treasures of Lungchen, it is also said that and then there are also comments in some of the commentaries of Lungchen Zodun that this some of this Huashang's view could not be absorbed by the Tibetans because of lack of merit. So it is really important to understand all of them in their different context. Now in that case, it could be thought that in the case of a person with high realization, when you engage in a practice where you do not allow yourself clouded and obscured by misconceptions, by various discursive thoughts, and let your mind focus only on the most subtle mind, then there is one kind of process or practice. So therefore, do not be under the impression that Tsongkhapa is refuting the Haishang's view and therefore refuting some of the viewpoints of Longchen. This is not the case. And just as there is a critical analysis of in the teaching of Tsongkhapa, similarly, in the case of Longchen Ramjamba also, he is a master who is well versed with many sources and quotations, and in fact he got the name that master with many quotations. So he is clear that he is also not saying that all thoughts are wrong, and in the line of certain Dzogchen practices, he would also encourage engaging in a thoughtless kind of meditation. And likewise, in the Gelugpa practice, in the practice of Tsongkhapa also, if you read some of the higher commentaries on Gyuha Samaja and so forth, and when you use the mental bliss as the subjective mind that focuses on emptiness, then you do not engage in analytical meditation, but engage in one-pointed meditation. So therefore, do not get confused or carried away by one word or few sentences. It is important to read all the texts of Tsongkhapa and all the texts of Longchen Ramjamba. Then you will be able to understand that all these teachings finally boil down on the same point. So if you just speak one or few words and few sentences and then highlight the differences, then it's a clear sign of your limited knowledge. For example, in the teaching on parting the four clingings, there is one of the parting of the four clingings is says that if you have grasping, then there is no view. Now, when there is grasping, there is no view, again should be understood in its proper context. So do not wholeheartedly rely on the superficial meaning of the word, but understand the whole teaching and understand them in their proper context. So there is a kind of digression. Therefore, just setting your mind in a state that lacks any thought is the path of true pleasure Buddhahood. So there is the Haishang's viewpoint. Such virtues as generosity and ethical discipline, he says, are taught for foolish people incapable of such meditation on the definitive emptiness. To engage in those deeds after you have found the definitive would be like a king descending to a common status, or like finding an elephant and then searching for its footprints. Hoshang attempts to prove this position by citing from the sutras 80 passages which extol this state of mind that lacks any thought. Answer: Hoshang says everything to do with method is not an actual path to Buddhahood. It's a tremendous denial of the conventional. And since he refutes analyzing with discerning wisdom the selfless reality that is at the heart of Konkura's teaching, he banishes the system of the ultimate to the far distance. The great Bodhisattva Kamalashila excellently refuted with a mass of spiritual citation and stainless reasoning this epitome of wrong views, in which it is maintained that the sublime path consists of stabilizing the mind in a state that lacks any thought. Such stabilizing of the mind is a practice properly subsumed under the mere category of meditative serenity, no matter how superior it may be. Kamalashila then wrote at length on the good path pleasing to the conquerors. Nevertheless, there are still some who continue to do just what Hoshang did, because the total decline of the Buddha's teaching is drawing near. Because the excellent person who ascertained with total serenity, total certainty through scriptures of definitive meaning and stainless reasoning, all the key points of the path in their entirety are no more, because the merit of living beings is no minimal, and because there are so many who have little faith in the teaching and feeble intelligence. Some belittle the deeds that are part of the path, the vows which are to be kept and the like, rejecting them and so forth when they cultivate the path. Others do not accept Hajjang's mistaken denial of the factors method, but assert that his way of understanding the philosophical view is excellent, and still others cast aside descending wisdom and claim that Hajjang's meditation of not thinking is best. So such kind of statement as is done by Hajjang is possible even in the case of us, because of your own lack of knowledge and because of your reluctance to observe certain Buddhist conduct and discipline, you might end up saying that there's no need for you study, there's no need for you to understand the philosophical text and so forth. So in this way you might deny these excellent teachings. The path of these persons is indeed not at all in the direction or vicinity of a meditation on emptiness, but even if you were to allow that it is a meditation on emptiness, you would not then go on to say that those with the knowledge that comes from the cultivation of a faultless method of meditation, after they have found the unmistaken meaning of emptiness, should meditate on emptiness alone and not cultivate conventional states of mind pertaining to deeds, or alternatively do not have to strive at those conventional states of mind in a variety of ways, upholding them as the core practice. To say such things contradicts all the scriptures and completely flies in the face of reason, for the goal for practitioners of the Mahayana is a non-abiding nirvana. For this you have to achieve non-abiding in cycle existence via the wisdom that knows reality, the stages of the path contingent on the ultimate, the profound path, the collection of sublime wisdom, the so-called factor of wisdom. You also have to achieve a non-abiding in the peace that is nirvana via the wisdom that understands the diversity of phenomena, the stages of the path contingent on conventional truths, the vast path, the collection of merit, the so-called factor of method. As is said in the Sutra of Showing the Tathagata's Inconceivable Secret, the Questions of the Sky Treasure Sutra, the Sutra Unraveling the Intended Meaning, the Teaching of Vimalakirti, and so forth. Therefore, when you are on the path, right from the time of wanting the goal of Buddhahood, you must depend on both method and wisdom. You will not attain it by either one alone. As the foremost of Gaya says, if you summarize the paths for Bodhisattvas, there are these two. Which two? Method and wisdom. The glorious first and foremost Tantra also states, the perfection of wisdom is the mother, skill in means is the father. And the Kashyapa chapter also says, Kashyapa, it is like this. Just as kings informed by ministers perform all royal duties, so too, the wisdom of Bodhisattvas imbued with skill in means performs all the deeds of a Buddha. Therefore, meditate on emptiness that has the supremacy of being associated with all aspects. There is an emptiness that is complete in all facets of method, generous and so forth. By meditating on emptiness in isolation, you will never reach the Mahayana path, as is said in the Questions of the Crest Jewel Sutra, Ratanachur Sutra. And as is also said in the Sublime Continuum comments on this passage as follows. Generosity, ethical discipline, patience and so forth, these are the painters. Emptiness, supreme in all aspects, is said to be the likeness. This uses the analogy of assembling a group of artists to paint a king's likeness. One knows how to paint a head but not something else. One knows how to paint a hand but not something else. And so on. If even one artist is missing, the painting will not get finished. The king's likeness is analogous to emptiness, and the painter's analogous to generosity and so forth. So if method, generosity and so forth is incomplete, it would be like a decapitated or amputated likeness. Furthermore, to take emptiness in isolation as what is to be meditated on and say, there is no need to cultivate anything else, expresses an idea that the Bhagavan set forth as a view to be opposed, and he thereupon refuted it. Were the statement true, then the many eons of a Bodhisattva's practice of generosity, observance of ethical discipline, etc. would be an exercise in faulty wisdom that did not comprehend the definitive, as the Bhagavan says in the Sutra Gathering All the Threads, Sarva Vedilaya Samgraha Sutra. Therefore, to say it is unnecessary for someone who knows emptiness to strive hard to cultivate method is a mistaken denial that states in effect the period of our teacher's previous only lifetimes was a time when he had no understanding of the definitive. opponent's possession. Practicing the deeds of generity and so forth in a variety of ways is for when you do not have a firm knowledge of emptiness. When you do have this firm knowledge, then this is enough. This is exactly what the Hashang said. Reply: this is a very wrong view. If it were correct, then the children of the conquerors who have ascended to the great levels where they have attained the non-conceptual sublime wisdom that perceives the ultimate truth, and in particular the 8th level bodhisattvas who have control over non-conceptual wisdom, would not need the bodhisattva deeds. This is incorrect because the sutra of the 10 levels says that even though on each of the 10 levels there is an emphasis on one of the deeds, generosity, etc., it is not the case that they do not perform the other deeds. So it is said that they practice all 6 or 10 perfections on each level. Further, since Ajita, Maitreya, Nagarjuna and Asanga explain the meaning of these sutras in this fashion, it is not possible to interpret them otherwise. In particular, bodhisattvas eliminate all afflictions on the 8th level. Therefore, when they stabilize on the ultimate, wherein they have quelled all elaboration, the Buddhas exhort them, explaining that they have to train in the bodhisattva deeds. With just this knowledge of emptiness, you cannot become enlightened, because the Sharvakas and Pratika Buddhas have also obtained this non-conceptuality. And look at my immeasurable body, immeasurable sublime wisdom, immeasurable realm and so forth. You also do not have my powers and so on. Joyously persevere for the sake of these attributes. Think about the living beings not at peace, disturbed by various afflictions, but do not discard this forbearance, meditation on emptiness and so forth. To be satisfied with a certain trivial meditative concentration and to set aside everything else is something ridiculed by scholars, as the sutra on the 10 level states. The sutra on the 10 levels also gives the example of a ship sailing out to sea, driven by a favorable wind. The distance it covers in a single day exceeds the distance it goes even in 100 years after starting from port without a wind and using effort to move it. Likewise, it says, after you have reached the 8th level, without a great effort, you cover in just a moment an amount of the path to omniscience not possible before reaching this level, even if you are to strive at the path for 100,000 eons. You fool yourself, therefore, by saying, I have a shortcut, and then not learning the bodhisattva deeds. Opponent's position: I do not assert that generosity and so forth are unnecessary, but rather that they are fully present in the state of mind that lacks any thought, because the absence of adherence to a giver, gift and recipient makes non-apprehending generosity fully present, and in the same way the remaining perfections are fully present too. It is also because the sutra said that you include the practice of the 6 perfections within the practice of each. Reply: if they are fully present in a state of mind that lacks thought, then when non-Buddhist meditators are in meditative equipoise, even in a single pointed state of serenity, all the perfections would be fully present, because they also are not adhering to a giver, gift and recipient. In particular, when Sarvakas and Pratyeka Buddhas non-conceptually perceive the real nature, as in the earlier quotation from the sutra on the 10 levels, all bodhisattva deeds would be fully present, so they would absurdly be Mahayana practitioners. And if you assert that just one practice is sufficient because the sutras say that all 6 perfections are included in each, well then, since it also says all 6 are present even when offering a mandala while reciting the verse beginning giving cow dung together with water and so forth, it would also be enough to do only this. Deeds imbued with the philosophical view and wisdom imbued with method may be understood by way of an analogy. When a mother, stricken with grief at the death of her beloved child, engages in conversation and other activities with others, the feelings he expressed do not eliminate the force of her grief. So the main point emphasized is to harmonize the practice of method and wisdom. And also in the tantric practice, so in the sutric practice, this is the meaning of harmonious practice of method and wisdom. So this is a very clear example. For example, it says, when a mother stricken with grief at the death of her beloved child engages in conversation and other activities, like when she takes food, and so forth. And even while she is engaging all these conversation activities, the feelings she expressed do not eliminate the force of her grief, meaning that in the depth of her mind she is still full of grief. Yet not every feeling she expresses is necessarily grief. So similarly, if the wisdom that knows emptiness is very strong, even though the states of mind associated with the giving, making obeisance, circumambulating or reciting are not cognitions of emptiness, this still does not preclude your being involved in them while endowed with the potency or force of the cognition of emptiness. So the influence of cognition of emptiness is very there. For instance, at the start of a meditation session, if you first generate a very strong spirit of bodhicitta, then this spirit of bodhicitta is not manifestly there when you then enter meditative equipoise in a concentration of emptiness, yet this does not preclude these concentrations being imbued or influenced with the potency of the bodhicitta. It is this sort of thing that is referred to by the term non-apprehending generosity. It is not the complete absence of generous attitude wherein giving is not feasible. Understand the remaining perfections in a similar way. Know also that this is how method and wisdom are inseparable. But when you embrace tantric practice, particularly the highest form of tantric practice like Dzogchen or Mahamudra and so forth, then you develop this twin practice of method and wisdom within one entity of the mind. Furthermore, you should not misconstrue statements that things in cycle existence such as your body resources and long lifespan are the result of collections of merit. They are so only in the absence of skill in means and wisdom. When collections of merit are imbued with this, it is entirely proper that they are the causes of liberation and omniscience. These are limitless passages in the scriptures which say as much, such as the one from the precious garland. Moreover, it looks like you are saying that even all ill deeds and afflictions that cause the miserable dreams can sometimes become causes of Buddhahood, and the virtue, generosity, ethical discipline and so forth that lead to high status causes cycle existence but does not become a cause of Buddhahood. So compose yourself before you speak. Do not misconstrue the following statements from the sutras. Adhering to the six perfections, generosity and so forth is demonic activity. From the Three Hips Sutra also says, confess each of these, descending to the level of objective existence and giving gifts, observing ethical disciplines because of a belief in the supremacy of ethics, etc. And from the sutra requested by Brahma, also it states, all analysis is conceptual thought, the non-conceptual is enlightenment. The meaning of the first passage is that generosity, etc., motivated by mistaken adherence to the two types of self, is not pure and therefore is stated to be demonic activity. This passage does not teach that generosity and so forth is demonic activity. Otherwise, since it mentions all six perfections, you would also have to assert that the perfection of meditative stabilization and wisdom are also demonic activity. The second scriptural passage means that the perfections are impure because of being motivated by mistaken adherence and explains that you must confess them. It does not teach that you should not be involved in generosity, etc. Otherwise, the mention of a descent to the level of objective existence in the phrase descending to the level of objective existence and giving gifts would be unnecessary, and it would instead have stated confess the giving of gifts in general, which it does not in fact say. And this method of response formulated in the third stage of meditation emphasizes an extremely important point, because Hashang's view misunderstands this passage and asserts that the whole range of deeds is qualified by signs, wherein the deeds are taken to be the apprehension of signs of a self of persons and objects. If every sort of virtuous conceptual thought, such as the generosity attitude when thinking I shall give this thing, and the attitude of restraint when thinking I shall restrain from this wrongdoing, were an apprehension of a self of objects, that misconceives the three spheres, agent, object and recipient, when it would be right and proper that everyone finding the view of the selflessness of objects should completely reject virtuous conceptual thought, just as they reject hostility, pride, etc., and it would be quite wrong for them to purposely cultivate those virtues. So therefore, as I said earlier, again you should understand these meanings in their proper context. For example, when you come across a statement saying that if there is grasping, there is no view, it could be understood in different senses. One possible meaning could be, for example, when your mind is totally focused on emptiness, then at that point the mind is kind of merged into the ultimate state of emptiness, and there is no subject-to-object duality, and that should be the standard form of absorption into emptiness, or one-pointed focus on emptiness. So under such a situation, if there is a grasping in the sense of seeing the subject and the object emptiness as separate, and if you develop the grasping of emptiness, then that is not the pure view. If all conceptual thoughts which think this is this were conceptions of the self of objects that misconceive the three spheres, then what about contemplating the good qualities of a teacher, contemplating leisure and opportunity, death and the suffering of the miserable realms, training in the practice of going for refuge, thinking how a certain action gives rise to a certain result, training in love, compassion and the spirit of enlightenment, and practicing the precepts of the engaged spirit of enlightenment? Since all of these paths require only that you induce certain knowledge by thinking, this is this, this comes from that, this has this good quality or that fault, you would increase your conception of a self objects commensurate to your certainty about these paths. Conversely, you would become less certain about these paths commensurate to the certain knowledge of this selflessness of objects you could sustain in meditation. The deeds component and view component would thus become mutually exclusive, like hot and cold, and you would then never develop a long-lasting and very forceful certainty about both the view and deeds. Therefore, just as in the context of the goal there is no contradiction that a Buddha's embodiment of truth and a Buddha's embodiment of form are both presented as attainments, so on the path you must induce without any contradiction. One, certain knowledge of the total freedom from any elaboration of the conception of science of true existence in the two kinds of self with respect to even a particle of mental object, and two, certain knowledge that this comes from that and this has this good quality or that fault. This in turn is contingent on how you determine the two truths, the philosophical view of what exists. You are counted a person who knows the true truths and who has found the conqueror's intent. If you are convinced that the following two valid cognitions not only do not of course harm each other, but rather aid each other. One, the valid cognition that establishes the ultimate, which is determined through scripture and reasoning to be the absence of even a particle of essential nature in the way of being or ontological status of any phenomena of cycle existence or nirvana, and two, the conventional valid cognition that establishes that causes and effects in their diverse workings are certain without any confusion of even the slightest cause or effect. I shall explain this system in the insight section. As to the third spiritual passage, the one from the sutra requested by Brahma, since the context for this passage in the sutra is an analysis of production and so forth, in order to teach the generosity, etc., are not absolutely produced, it uses the term conceptual thought to indicate that they are mere imputations by conceptual thought. It is not teaching that you should not involve yourself in these deeds and reject them. Therefore, since there is no time when it is not necessary to practice these deeds, the six perfections, etc., until you become a Buddha, it is incumbent upon you to train in these deeds. If you strive right now from the depths of your heart, you will accomplish with effort what you can achieve. With respect to the practices that you are unable to do for the time being, make an aspiration to do them, and as causes of the ability to practice them, accumulate the collections, clear away the obscurations, and make many aspirational prayers. Once you do this, it will not be long before you put them into practice. Otherwise, if you take the position that you personally cannot understand the deeds or cannot do them, and you then say to others, you do not need to train in them, not only do you ruin yourself and bring ruin on others as well, but it also becomes a condition for the decline of the teaching. So do not do this, as Nagarjuna's compendium of sutra states, and also the sutra of hearing the Tathagata's inconceivably secret states. You must distinguish between explanations of how there is an observed object and explanations of how there is an observed object. Accordingly, while you must loosen the bonds of the afflictions and the conceptions of science of true existence, you must be firmly bound by the rope of ethical training, and while you need to eradicate both kinds of misdeeds, you must not eradicate virtuous activities. Being bound by ethical training and being bound by conceiving signs of true existence are not the same, and loosening the safeguards of vows and loosening the chain of the conceptions of self are not the same either. You achieve omniscience from a number of causes, each of which is insufficient by itself. So know that the falling sort of person is a teacher of non-virtue who blocks the door to the two collections. Someone who says, hundreds of birds are driven out with a single stone from a slingshot, and who attains a fortunate life of leisure and should then take advantage of it in many ways, but rather does not train in anything other than one specific aspect of the path. Also, the difference between the Hinayana or Mahayana comes down to whether its practitioners train in the limitless collections at the time of putting the teachings into practice, because the modest vehicle and Hinayana are synonymous, and the meaning of the modest is partial. You must achieve even lesser current results, food, drink, and the like, through many causes and conditions. So it is quite wrong to hold that something partial is sufficient to achieve a person's highest purpose, Buddhahood, for it is the nature of dependent arising that results are made in accordance with their causes. With this in mind, the Buddha said in the Lotus of Compassion Sutra, that something partial comes from what is partial, and something total comes from what is total. This is explained at length in the Sutra of the Coming Forth for the Tathagatas, and also teaching of Vimalakirti, and in the Nagarjuna's precious garland. This training in method and wisdom, comprising the six perfections, is, as explained earlier, common to both the mantra and perfection vehicles. For in many of the Tantric classics, we find repeated mention of the complete path of the perfections, the six perfections, the 37 branches of enlightenment, the 16 emptinesses, etc., in the context of explanations that the entire celestial mansion, the area of resident deities, are the inner qualities of mind. Therefore, know that all the perfection of wisdom literature's explanations about what is to be adopted and what is to be discarded are comprehensively shared with the mantra vehicle, except in the case of the tantric teachings for certain exceptional persons, in which they must take the experience of a sensory object as the path and so forth. Take the above explanations as a seed and reflect on it well. If you are not then certain about a path that is not just partial but complete in all aspects, you have not comprehended the foundation of the Mahayana path in general. Therefore, intelligent ones generate a solid certainty about this path of method and wisdom, and in many ways continuously grow in your natural capacity for the supreme vehicle. Next is training in the Mahayana precepts and perfections, explanation of the process of learning the precepts. This has two parts. The first is how to train in the Mahayana in general. This has three sections. First is establishing the desire to learn the precepts of the Spirit of Enlightenment. In the discipline of individual liberation and in Tantra, it is inappropriate to study the precepts before you have first taken the vows. But this Bodhisattva vows are different. First you understand the precepts well, and then after you are trained in them, if you have an enthusiasm for taking them, you are given the vows, as is said in the Bodhisattva levels. In the case of this Bodhisattva level, it is said that the Chinese translation has many volumes, and the Tibetan translation has six volumes. This is a very good method, because if you understand the precepts, bring them to mind, establish a wish to train in them from the depths of your heart, and then take the vows, you will be extremely constant. To explain the precepts both here and below would make for too great a burden of words, so I shall indicate them below. taking the vows of Kankura's children after establishing the desire to learn the precepts. I have already established in detail in my Basic Path to Awakening commentary on the Bodhisattva Levels chapter on ethical discipline. First, how to take the Bodhisattva vows. Immediately after that, how to guard against fundamental transgressions and transgressions which constitute minor infractions, and then how to repair vows if they degenerate. It is most definitely necessary that you do this before you take the vows, so understand them before from there. So in the case of Bodhisattva vows, first you should, unlike the Pratimoksha vows, first you should know the precepts and the vows, and then after which, if you are sure that you can undertake the practice of the precepts, and then you receive the Bodhisattva vow. Now in the case of the Tantric initiations and Pratimoksha vows, first you receive the vows, you receive the initiations, and of course in this regard one of the most important thing is to examine the teacher, and the Lama would examine the students. So in the case of Vinaya and Mantra, first you are given the vows and the precepts, then after that you listen to the precepts. Now in the case of the Bodhisattvas, first you study the precepts, and then when you develop enthusiasm, you receive the vows. Next is how to train after taking the vows. How to train after taking the vows has three parts, and the first is what the precepts are based upon. And in the case of taking the vows of Kankura's children after establishing the desire to learn the precepts, Tsongkhapa asks you to read his own composition, Basic Path to Awakening, or Changchub Shunglam. So as is taught in the chapter on morality, I will confer the Bodhisattva vow at a certain point during this teaching. Next is how to train after taking the vows. This is three parts. The first is what the precepts are based upon. There are limitless clear categorizations or classifications, but if you arrange the Bodhisattva precepts by type, you can include them all within the six perfections. The six perfections are thus the great condensation of all the key points of the Bodhisattva path, the four ways to gather disciples, and also included within these six perfections are as follows. That generosity is included is obvious. Pleasant speech is giving instructions to disciples, taking the six perfections as the point of departure. Working at the aims is establishing others in the aims of these instructions, and consistency of behavior is practicing just as the disciple does. Although it is true that the entire Bodhisattva path is also subsumed under the other condensations such as the two collections, the three trainings, and so forth, these are not able to produce the understanding that the six perfections do, so the six perfections are the best inclusive set. Next, how all the precepts are included in the six perfections. And if you read Maitreya's Sutra Alamkara, you will find a very extensive explanation of the six perfections. And there is a summary explanation in the Maitreya's Ornament of Realization, a discussion with the main topic, the fixed number of perfections. The Bhagavan formulated a bare outline of the six perfections, and the holy regent Maitreya produced certain knowledge of this by explicating, in accord with the Buddha's intended meaning, the key points of the rationale for formulating the perfections in that fashion. These explanations show that there is a fixed number of perfections. When you are convinced of this and astonished by it, you will understand the practice of the six perfections as the supreme instructions, so obtain such conviction. The discussion of the main topic, the fixed number of perfections, has six parts. The first is fixed number of perfections based on high status. To fully complete the great, perfect, effective Bodhisattva deeds, you need an immeasurably long succession of lifetimes. Moreover, to attain quick success on the path within these lifetimes, you need a life excellent in every aspect. Our present life is not excellent in every aspect, but rather has only some of the aspects of full excellence. We do not make progress with it, though we practice the teachings. You need a life that has four kinds of excellence. 1. Resources to use. 2. A body with which you act. 3. Companions together with whom you act. 4. Work that you are able to accomplish once undertaken. Since in many cases these four kinds of excellence alone may themselves become conditions for afflictions, you must not fall under the control of the afflictions. As just the four kinds of excellence are not sufficient, you must also distinguish well in regard to what to adopt and what to cast aside, precisely what things to do and to stop doing. Otherwise, just as a bamboo or plantain tree dies after giving fruit, or a mule dies with pregnancy, you will be destroyed by the four excellences. The wise understand how these six, the four excellences, and control of the afflictions, and knowledge of what to adopt and what to cast aside, are the results of earlier virtuous actions, and they strive again at steadily increasing their courses. The unwise use the results of their earlier accumulations of virtue and exhaust them. As they do not increase them anew, they reach the brink of their future suffering. When you again produce these six in future also, their production will not be causeless or from discordant causes, but rather from concordant causes. There are the perfections fixed as six in number. Therefore, in this lifetime, you must repeatedly habituate yourself to constant reliance on the six perfections, because the superiority of the effects is commensurate to the superiority of the causes. A life with the four excellences constitutes temporary high status, whereas the ultimate high status, which consists of ultimate excellence of body, etc., exists at the Buddha level, as the ornament for the Mahayana Sutra states. Next is the fixed number of perfections based on fulfilling the two aims. When someone in such a life of high status learns the Bodhisattva deeds, these activities are comprehensively categorized as two: those which fulfill your own aim and those which fulfill the aims of others. Therefore, there is a fixed number of perfections based on fulfilling the two aims. To fulfill the aims of others, you must first help them with material goods. Since no benefit will come from generosity accompanied by harmfulness towards living beings, you need either discipline, which has a great purpose for others in that it is the state of desisting from harm to others and the causes of such harm. To bring this to its full development, you also need patience that disregards the harm done to you. For if you are impatient with harm and retaliate a time or two, you will not attain pure ethical discipline. When you do not retaliate because of your patience, you prevent others from accumulating a great amount of sin and bring them to virtue by inspiring them with your patience. So this practice has a great purpose for others. You attain your own aim, the bliss of liberation, through the power of wisdom. Since you will not attain this with a distracted mind, you must set your mind in meditative equipoise by means of meditative stabilization, obtaining a mental serviceability wherein you intentionally set your attention on any object of meditation. Since a lazy person does not produce this, you need joyous perseverance day and night that never slackens. So this is the basis of the other perfections. For accomplishing the two aims, then the number of perfections is fixed as six, as the ornament of the Mahayana Sutra says. In these six, there is no complete fulfillment of other aims. The mention of stabilization and liberation differentiates between the two, as one, the stabilization of the mind on the object of meditation, this being the imprint of meditative stabilization, and two, the liberation from cyclic existence, this being the imprint of wisdom. Notice that this does not mistake meditative serenity for insight. As this is so, those who assert that the meditation of fixing one's attention in an absence of conceptual thought is meditation on the profound, are speaking of a meditation that is a single portion of the meditative stabilization that is one of these six perfections. You must attain certain knowledge of these six perfections in their entirety. Next is the fixed number of perfections based on perfecting the complete fulfillment of others' aims. You first relieve others' poverty by giving away material goods. Then you do not harm to any living being, and in addition are patient with harm done to you. Without becoming dispirited, you joyously persevere at helping those who harm you. You depend on meditative stabilization and inspire them through displaying supernormal powers and so forth. When they become suitable vessels for the teachings, you rely on wisdom and giving good explanations, cut through their doubts and thereby bring them to liberation. Because you do all this, the perfections are fixed as six in number. These words from the ornament of the Mahayana Sutra, together with the one above, says that it is not possible to fulfill others and your own aims without relying on the six perfections. Once you are certain about the way in which you fulfill your own and others' aims through these six perfections, you will have respect for the practice of them. And the next is the fixed number of perfections based on their subsuming the entire Mahayana. You are indifferent to resources because you are not attached to those you have and do not pursue those you lack. Since you then have the ability to safeguard your precepts, you adopt and respect ethical discipline. You are patient with the suffering that comes from living beings and inanimate things, and you are enthusiastic about whatever virtue you set out to cultivate, so you do not get dispirited by either of these. You cultivate a non-discursive yoga of meditative serenity and non-discursive yoga of insight. These six comprise all the Mahayana practices through which you advance by the six perfections, for you accomplish these practices in stages by means of the six perfections, and you do not need any more than these six perfections, as the ornament of the Mahayana Sutra states. The entire Mahayana is summed up in not delighting resources, reverence, not being dispirited in two ways, and the yoga is free of the discursiveness. Given this, it is a contradiction to want to enter the Mahayana and yet to reject the practice of the six perfections. And the next is the fixed number of perfections in terms of the completeness of paths and methods. The path, that is method, for not being attached to the resources that are your possessions, is generosity, because you become free from attachment to your things by becoming habituated to give them away. The method for restraining yourself from the distraction of trying to possess what you do not possess is ethical discipline, for when you maintain a monk's vows, you do not have all the distractions of making a living. The method for not abandoning living beings is patience, because you do not despair at the suffering caused by the harm others inflict. The methods to increase virtues is joyous perseverance, because you increase them when you joyously persevere at what you undertake. The methods for clearing away obscurations are the final two perfections, because meditative stabilization clears away the afflictions, and wisdom clears away the cognitive obscurations. Thus the perfections are fixed as in six number, as the ornament of Mahayana Sutra states. The following explanation produces strong conviction about the six perfections. In order to avoid being dominated by the distraction of sensual objects, you need generosity that is free from attachment. To prevent sensory experiences that have not occurred, you need ethical discipline that restrains distractions by things that are pointless. Given that pointless or counterproductive, given that there are a great number of living beings whose behavior is bad and who you are constantly in danger of meeting, you need a powerful conditioning to patience as a remedy for giving up their welfare. In order to increase virtue in terms of the great number of actions and its practice over long periods of time, you need joyous perseverance that has the intense and long-term enthusiasm that comes from reflecting on the benefits of virtuous actions, etc. In order to suppress afflictions, you need meditative stabilization, and to destroy their seeds and the cognitive obscurations, you need wisdom. Next is the fixed number of perfections based on the three trainings. The nature of the training ethical discipline is the practice of ethical discipline. The precondition of the training in ethical discipline is generosity, because once you have generosity that is indifferent to resources, you can properly adopt an ethical discipline. The aid to the training ethical discipline is patience, because the patience of not retaliating when scolded, etc., safeguards your properly adopted ethical discipline. Meditative stabilization is the training of mind, and wisdom is the training in wisdom. As for joyous perseverance, it is included in all three trainings, so the perfections are fixed at six in number, as the ornament of Mahayana Sutra states. By a certain kind of excellent love, you bring to completion either or others or your own aims. You practice certain kinds of training by possessing a diversity of methods depending on which vehicle you are in. Understand in this way that the six perfections comprise and bring to completion the above perspectives on their fixed number, life, aims and the Mahayana, the methods and the trainings. Reflect until you get a deep conviction about how the six perfections are the summation of all the key points of Bodhisattva practice. Furthermore, there are two causes of note: initially transcending or rising above cycle existence, attachment to resources and attachment to a home. The remedies for this are generosity and ethical discipline respectively. You may rise above these attachments once, but still turn back without reaching the end. There are two causes of this: suffering from the wrongdoing of living beings and becoming dispirited at the length of time you have pursued virtue. The remedies for this are patience and joyous perseverance respectively. Once you understand how to sustain disregard for all suffering and harm, as well as an enthusiasm which views even an eternity as though it were one day, you must practice them in various ways. If you do this, you will produce the patience and joyous perseverance that are capable of functioning as remedies to what causes you turn back. Thus, they are extremely crucial. Never mind the matter of the Bodhisattva deeds, even with regard to present-day cultivation of virtue, there are many who start out, but few who do not turn back after a while, because one, their forbearance for the slightest hardship is tiny, and two, their enthusiasm for the path they cultivate is tepid. This is the result of their not putting into practice the personal instructions associated with the patience and joyous perseverance. There are two causes for letting your virtue go to waste, even if you do not turn back after a while: distraction, wherein your attention does not stabilize on a virtue subject to meditation, and faulty wisdom. The remedies for this are meditative stabilization and wisdom, respectively. Meditative stabilization is a remedy because it is said that even when virtuous practices such as repetition of mantra and daily recitations are senseless if your attention wanders elsewhere. Wisdom is a remedy because if you fail to develop the wisdom that fully delineates the topics of the collections of Buddhist knowledge, you will be mistaken about what to adopt and what to cast aside, even the obvious, and will then conduct yourself wrongly. This fixes the number of perfections at six in terms of their being remedies that eliminate the class of phenomena that are incompatible with virtue. The number of perfections is fixed at six based on the fact that they are the foundation for achieving every quality of a Buddha. This is because the first four perfections are preconditions for meditative stabilization. So through these four you accomplish meditative stabilization, the perfection of non-destruction. Furthermore, when you cultivate insight based on this, you will know reality. Fixing the number of perfections at six in terms of their being concordant with the helping living beings to measure is similar in meaning to the third one mentioned earlier. Next is an ancillary discussion of the fixed order of the perfection, which is explained in three parts. First is the order of arising. When you have a generosity that is disinterested in and unattached to resources, you take up ethical discipline. When you have an ethical discipline which restrains you from wrongdoing, you become patient with those who you harm. When you have the patience wherein you do not become dispirited with hardships, the conditions for rejecting virtue are few, so you are able to persevere joyously. Once you joyously persevere day and night, you will produce the meditative concentration that facilitates the application of your attention to virtuous objects of meditation. When your mind is in meditative equipoise, you will know reality exactly. And next is the order in terms of inferior and superior. Each preceding perfection is inferior to the superior one that follows it. Next, the order in terms of coarse and subtle, each preceding perfection is easier than the subsequent one to engage in and perform, so it is coarser than the subsequent one. Each subsequent perfection is more difficult than the preceding one to engage in and perform, so it is more subtle than the preceding one. Next is the process of learning the perfections. This has two parts. The first part is how to train in the Bodhisattva deeds in general. This has two parts. First is training in the perfections that measure the qualities you will have when you become a Buddha. This has six parts. First is how to train in the perfection of generosity, which has four sections. The first section is what generosity is. This is as is stated in the Bodhisattva level. Hence, it is the virtue of generous attitude and the physical and verbal actions which are motivated by this. Bringing the perfection of generosity to completion is not contingent on removing beings' poverty by giving gifts to others. Otherwise, since there still remain many destitute living beings, all the earlier Buddhas would not have attained perfect generosity. Therefore, the physical and verbal aspects of generosity are not the main thing. The main thing is the mental aspect. This is because you perfect generosity after you destroy your stingy clinging to all that you own, your body, resources and roots of virtue, and you completely condition your mind to giving them away to living beings from the depths of your heart, and not only that but also giving to others the effects of this giving as well. Thus, as is said in Bodhicharyavatara, thus the practice of the perfection of generosity entails generating in various ways the intention to give and steadily increasing this generosity, even though you may not be actually giving away something to others. Next is how to begin the development of generosity. Simply destroying all stinginess in regard to your body and resources is not the perfection of generosity. For stinginess is included within attachment, and so even the two kinds of hinayana arhats have totally eliminated along with its seeds. What is required then is that you not only clear away stinginess, tight-fistedness, which prevents giving things away, but also that you develop from the depths of your heart the intention to give away to others all your possessions. For this, you have to meditate on the faults of holding on to things and the benefits of giving them away. I shall therefore discuss this, as is said in the Moonlam Sutra, where it says that the childish people are attached to this rotting body and to this rushing life force, both of which lack independence and are like a dream or a magician's illusion. So these unintelligent beings do terrible things, fall under the control of sins, and carried away by the chariot of death's lord, proceed to unbearable hells. This says that you should stop attachment by viewing the body as unclean, life as rushing like a mountain cascade, both body and life as devoid of an independent self because they are under the control of karma, and both as false like a dream or a magician's illusion. Furthermore, if you do not stop attachment, you will become dominated by it, building up great wrongdoing, and proceed to miserable realm, as is said in the formula that accomplishes limitless methods, and also the compendium of training, and also the garland of birth story states. Though you make much effort to care for your body which has no substance, you have to discard it. By sincerely giving it away to others, you fulfill many of your own and others' aims. After you think, I would be a fool not to train my mind to do this. Do whatever you can to produce the thought of giving away your body and the like to others, as Shantideva says, and also the compendium of perfection states. If you dedicate from the depths of your heart all roots of virtue, however great or small they may be, for the sake of accomplishing both temporarily and ultimately extensive benefit and happiness for all living beings, and then give something you obtain merit related to each living being, hence you easily complete the collection of merit, as the precious Galen states. Furthermore, do not hold on to companions and belongings that have prevented you from increasing your ability to give things away, that have intensified your stinginess, that have stopped the development of previously absent inclinations to give, or that have weakened your inclinations to give. Do not take on these kinds of companions or accept these kinds of material gifts, even if others offer them, as the compendium of the perfection states. When you act in this way, stinginess may lead you to feel attached to your goals. If so, become unattached by thinking. The sage reached enlightenment after he gave away every possession. Previously recalling my commitment to emulate him, I gave away my body, every resource and all my virtue to all living beings. If I am still attached to resources, I am behaving just like an elephant oppressed by the sun, who goes into the water and bathes, and then back on dry land, rolls in the dirt. Then again, after it sees that it is covered in dirt, it goes back into the water and does the same thing over again, as the compendium of the perfection states. If you are able to generate intense delight as you contemplate the many benefits of giving things away, and great fear as you reflect on the faults of tight-fistedness, you will naturally produce a generous attitude. Accordingly, generate the thought of giving away everything to others at the conclusion of cultivating of love and compassion, or at the conclusion of reflecting on the life stories of the Buddha, his bodhisattvas and so forth, as he said in the engaging in the bodhisattva deeds. I will give away without a sense of loss my body and my resources, as well as all my virtue from the past, present and future, for the welfare of all living beings. So with this Tsongkhapa's comment on the elephant rolling in the dirt, His Holiness says probably this explanation that Tsongkhapa made is not correct, in the sense that in Tibet there is no elephant, and he must have felt that the elephant also rolls on the dirt as the horses and donkeys do. I think all elephants don't roll like that on the dirt. You focus on three things: your body, your resources and your roots of virtue, and mentally give them away to all living beings. If you stop the craving that conceives everything to be your personal property, and then repeatedly condition yourself to the attitude of giving it all away to others, you will be called a bodhisattva, as the compendium of perfection says. All these things are yours. I have no pride that they are mine. Someone who has this amazing thought repeatedly and emulates the qualities of the perfect Buddha is called a bodhisattva. So said the inconceivable Buddha, the Supreme Being. At present, as your determination is not matured and is weak, and you do not actually give away flesh, etc., though you have already mentally given your body to all beings, according to the compendium of trainings, however, if you do not train in the thought of giving away your body and life, you will not become accustomed to it, and so will remain incapable of giving away your body and life. Therefore, from now on, cultivate this thought. If you use food, clothes, shelter and so on that you have sincerely given away to all beings, and you do so with craving for your personal welfare, forgetting the thought, I will use them for others' welfare, then you commit a major infraction. When you have no craving but forget to apply the idea of focusing on all living beings, or if you use those resources for a particular living being out of attachment, you commit a minor infraction. With regard to the material goods that you have turned over to others, the compendium of training states that when you use them for your own welfare, fully cognizant of their being the property of others, you are stealing, and if the total value is enough, you commit a cardinal transgression of the vows of individual liberation. In response to this, some say that since you have turned over your food, etc., to all living beings, it is impossible for the total value of any one being's portion to be enough, so you cannot commit a cardinal transgression. Others say this is not correct because you have turned over your belongings as a whole to each being individually. Others argue that even though you have mentally surrendered them to others, they do not take personal possession of them, so there is no cardinal transgression. The intended meaning behind the compendium of training statement is that you incur a cardinal transgression when you sincerely turn your food, etc., over to a human being, and this person knows that it and takes possession, whereupon you fully cognizant of their being another's property, appropriate them for your own use. Therefore, the possession stated by the others are wrong. There is no fault in using some living being's resources if you think, while using them, I do this for their welfare, as the compendium of training states. You may think I incur a fault because after I have turned over these belongings to living beings, I use them without their permission, but there is no fault, as the compendium of training states. Do not lack faith and think mentally giving everything away to living beings while not actually giving it is tantamount to a lie and therefore is without real substance, as the compendium of training says. Next is the divisions of generosity. This has three parts. The first is how everyone should practice it. That is, both the lay persons and ordained persons should practice it. Asanga's Mahayana compendium says that you practice generosity in association with the six supremacies. Supreme basis means that you practice generosity based on the spirit of enlightenment, that you act after you have been motivated by it. Supreme things means that in general you give all objects that can be given, and even when you are engaged in specific acts of generosity, you do not give up this thought of giving away everything. So this is like giving food, giving clothing. And supreme aim is when you give things away to all living beings for the sake of their immediate happiness and ultimate benefit. Supreme skill in means is said to be when generosity is imbued with non-conceptual sublime wisdom. Beginning bodhisattvas should take this to be the wisdom that knows the lack of intrinsic nature in objects. Supreme dedication means that you dedicate the virtue from generosity to complete enlightenment. Supreme purity is when you stop both the afflictive and cognitive obscurations. As Haribhadra's long explanation of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra in 8000 lines says that you practice generosity with the six perfections present. When you are giving the teachings, for instance, it is extremely powerful if you practice all six perfections. You have ethical discipline when you restrain yourself from the considerations of Sarvakas and Pratyek Buddhas. Patience when you bear any hardship while you aspire the qualities of omniscience, and when you are patient with the abuse from others. Joyous perseverance when you yearn for the ever greater increase of your generosity. Meditative stabilization when you dedicate to complete enlightenment the virtue that you cultivate with one-pointed attention unmixed with Hinayana considerations. And wisdom when you know that the giver, gift and recipient are like a magician's illusion. Next is divisions of generosity to particular persons. In general, it is said that lay bodhisattvas make gifts of material things and renunciate bodhisattvas make gifts of teachings, as the bodhisattva vows of liberation says. The compendium of training says the Buddha intended here material gifts that would become a hindrance to study and the like. It is said that renunciates are prohibited from making offerings of material goods that they have worked to obtain, but they must give them away if they obtain many things through the force of their previous merit and without hindering their virtuous activities. Also Sharava says, I am not talking to you about the benefits of giving, I am talking to you about the faults of tight-fistedness. It is displeasing news when renunciates harm their ethical discipline as they strain to the utmost in their search for wealth to give away. Next is divisions of actual generosity. This has three parts. First is the gift of the teachings. The gift of the teachings is teaching the sublime teaching without making mistakes, teaching the arts and the like, and involving others in upholding the fundamental precepts. So this is not only giving Dharma teaching, but also giving skills like painting or crafts. For example, most of the painters paint the image of Buddha and so forth, and if you paint them honestly and faithfully, then you will also collect merit and will also help others. And similarly, the teachers who teach in various schools, they also provide their students an opportunity to blossom the fresh intelligence of the students. So these are also gifts that accord the Dharma teaching. On the other hand, if you teach people how to make guns or artilleries and so forth, and these are not good gifts. Next is the gift of fearlessness. The gift of fearlessness is protecting living beings from fear of humans such as kings and robbers, from fear of non-human beings such as lions, tigers and crocodiles, and from fear of the elements such as water and fire. Material gifts, this is two parts. The first is the generosity of actually giving material things. This is three parts. First is how to give away material things. This is four sections. The first is the recipients of giving. These are there are 10 of these. 1. Friends and relatives who help you. Enemies who harm. 2. Enemies who harm you. 3. Ordinary people who neither harm nor help you. 4. Those with good qualities such as ethical discipline. 5. Those with flaws such as faulty ethical discipline. 6. Those inferior to you. 7. Those equal to you. 8. Those superior to you. 9. The rich and happy. 10. The miserable and destitute. Next is the motivation for giving, which is two sections. First is what kind of motivation is required. Your motivation should have three attributes. 1. A focus on purpose, which thinks, based on this I will complete the perfection of generosity, a precondition for unexcelled enlightenment. 2. A focus on the thing to be given, which thinks, from the outset a bodhisattva gives away all possessions to living beings, so the material goods that I am giving belong to others and it is as if they are receiving things kept in trust. And 3. A focus on the recipient, which thinks, since these recipients, whether asking for the gift or not, bring to completion my perfection of generosity, they are my teachers, as the compendium of perfection states. And with respect to giving away individual things, understand in detail from the questions of Subahu Sutra and the compendium of the perfections, your motivations focus on purpose, which is the thought, I will give this away for this or for that purpose. As to your motivations focus on the recipient explained above, you should apply it to all situations of generosity, so it is the general motivation. Specific motivations would be when you make a gift to those who harm you, once you have established a loving attitude to those who suffer, once you have established a compassionate attitude to those who have good qualities, once you have established an attitude of delight, and to those who help you, once you have established an impartial attitude. Moreover, you must be even-minded toward all recipients, give away to all living beings, such as those who ask and so forth, all the virtuous results of giving, and in particular be compassionate to those recipients who are suffering, as Chandrakirti states, and the praise of infinite quality states. Next is what kind of motivation must be eliminated. A motivation that believes in the supremacy of bad views. Lacking this means that you do not give while thinking there is no result from generosity. Harmful blood offerings are religious. Or I am giving as I apply myself to what is good and beneficial. Or through just the completion of generosity alone I will be free of mundane and supramundane attachments. 2. A motivation that is arrogant. Lacking this means that you do not despise the person who asks us for something. You do not compete with others, and after you give something you do not conceitedly think, I am so generous, no one else can do like this. So when you undertake the practice of giving, for example, if you give something to the beggars, do not give to them by belittling them, by looking them down. Should undertake the practice of giving through some kind of respect. But if they are asking more and more, then probably you should be the best judge of the situation. And on the one hand, these poor beggars are really object of compassion, but it is sometimes, you know, you will find them too much. They will corner you, and if you give one, they will ask for two. If you give two, they ask for more. On the other hand, from your side, you should not undertake the practice of giving through competitiveness. For example, there is no use for you saying that I gave 10 rupees to the beggar and keep on advertising what you have given. The purification of the obscurations of Karma Sutra explains that when ordinary beings make gifts, they lose faith in those who are stingy, on account of which they get angry and reborn in hell. So it is said that this obstructs generosity. When these ordinary persons observe ethical discipline, they speak unflatteringly of those whose ethical discipline is faulty, so they lose faith in many living beings and fall into miserable realms on account of their loss of faith. And when these ordinary people maintain patience and the like, they speak disparagingly of those who do the opposite of this, and so obstruct their own ethical discipline and so forth. Hence you should do as the praise of infinite quality says. 3. A motivation for support. Lacking this means that you do not give with the hope of getting praise or fame. Motivation of discouragement. Lacking this means that when you give after becoming joyful, even before the act of giving, you are filled with faith and then have no regret after giving. And even when you hear about a bodhisattva's vast acts of generosity, you are not discouraged but intensify your enthusiasm about belittling yourself. 5. A motivation in which you turn your back on someone. Lacking this means that you give out of an even-minded compassion that is impartial toward enemy, friend, and ordinary persons. A motivation of expecting something in return. And if you give something expecting something in return, then this is not giving, this is a business. So lacking this means that you do not give to others out of the hope that they will help you, but because you see that these beings are bereft of happiness, burned by the flames of craving, without the power to relieve their suffering and naturally miserable. 7. A motivation of expecting fruition. Lacking this means that you do not hope for the fruition of an excellent body and resources in future lives, but give because you see that all composite things are without all substance but can contribute to unexcelled enlightenment. This does not stop you from expecting these results in the short term, but stops you from taking the mere body and resource of cycle existence to be your goal. Besides this, you should give without the motivation of wrong livelihood, in which you think, if I make this gift, the ruler, etc., will recognize me as a generous person and I will get some respect. Do not give from fear of becoming poor or with the motivation to deceive someone who asks for something. Give something when you are free from distraction and feelings of dislike or anger. Make gifts when you are not dispirited due to the various wrong actions of the one who asks for something. Even when you see the faults of someone who has deceived you, etc., do not give with the motivation of proclaim these faults to others. Finally, give in the belief from which others cannot deceive you, that each individual act of giving will give rise to an individual result. So on the 29th day of that month, the 5 auspicious ladies of long life, together with many of their followers and local deities, came to visit the Jisun. They brought delicious food and excellent wine in jeweled beakers and offered them to Milarepa. After they had made obeisance to him and circled him many times, they stood in a row and said, "It is you, the Jisun, who have saved our lives and cured our illnesses. You have been most gracious to us." Whereupon with sweet voices they sang the following song. He who can foretell the fall of rain knows how to observe the sky. When one sees the dark clouds gather and the dragon thunders, he knows that the dragon king will soon give rain to nourish all sentient beings. When slowly the rain drizzles, it shows that moisture and heat are in balance on the earth. When the deafening thunder peals, it indicates the clashing conflict between heat and cold. Under the flying clouds stands great snow mountain with 3 peaks. The central one is highest. A crown of crystal is her head ornament. Starlight, soft and glimmering, surrounds her in the serene night. The rays of sun and moon gleam upon her. Beauteous and resplendent was she patient. There our noble castle stands. But the left slope of the snow mountain are the wondrous pastures of Medicine Valley. A canopy of rainbows ever hangs above it, reflecting beams of glowing light. Lovely are the herbs grown in the valley. Here dance and play the local gods. Here lies the land of crops and fruit, a garden full of lovely flowers. Your heart stands by the river bank, a place of great blessing where the great yogi Mila dwells. Through the merits of your previous lives, you receive a precious human body. by sloth unhindered, you meditate without diversion. Thus you have realized mind nature, the unborn, and mastered the magic gestures. No obstacles and distractions can frighten you. Unshakable as a mountain, you are a yogi of stability. Having mastered prana to perfection, you have no need of clothing, exposing your body freely. By your grace and your devotions, many beings have been saved. At a time of defilement, distress, you came to the red-faced country of Tibet. You are the glory of the world, our shelter and our pride. And similarly, the leader of the four Dakinis also sang. Thus, in making their pure wishes, the auspicious fair lady of long life led her four Dakini sisters in singing this song. The Jetun thought, now these malicious goddesses have shown their gratitude for me to healing their sickness. If I give them the preliminary instructions of the arising and perfecting yoga, they may be able to practice them. Then he said, fair ladies, with great sincerity you have now shown me your deep gratitude for the recovery of your health. Your words and attitude seem to have met the requirements for tantric teaching. I intend to give you an instruction through which you may forever free yourself from sufferings on the perilous path of samsara. But will you be able to practice it? Milarepa then sang them a song, The Growth of Joyousness. Under the canopy of sunlight in the east, towers the propitious peak of Mount Menla. Like the head of a crystal eagle, it reflects the glowing golden beams. The floating clouds are like a roof, and arched above it shines the rainbow. On the mountain's waist, the gem-like rocks are girdled in dense fog. Is this not the great snow mountain, queen of the azure heights? Residing on it are not five wondrous ladies. In an enchanting voice, one has just sung divinely. Is she not the fair lady of long life, most sparkling and most glamorous? This time you are really frightened, for you have lost your pride. Your body was torn with agonizing pains, and your wind was full of grievances. And your mind was full of grievances. Your breath was falling like a thinning mist, and your life was nearly at an end. All this was due to your past sinful deeds, a bitter retribution of the ripening karma. If from these sinful deeds you do not refrain, into the great hell you may fall perchance. That is more dreadful than any sickness. That you did not die is fortunate. Praiseworthy that your seed of faith has grown. With great compassion have I blessed you. Through the great power of Tantra have I saved you from the hand of death. All despair and misfortune has turned to good and boon. In joy you thanked me with deep gratitude, which in many others would be lacking. In a charming voice you have sung sweetly with good meaning. Hearing it, I too feel glad and joyful. If you would follow my instruction, please listen and remember well. Painful is the path of samsara. Perilous and hard to cross are the four rivers. Dismal is the forest of eight strivings. Hard to escape are the triple pardos dangers. To live under the constant threat of four devils is distressing, but here is a path of no fear, an escape from all miseries, leading to the land of bliss eternal. I may not be superb, but my lineage is supreme, from the great Dorje Chang, the sixth Buddha, to my teacher, the translator Marba. All the transmission gurus are Nirmanakayas. Never has our commoners corrupted in the lineage. Cherish then and value all my teachings. Next is reading from the Great Stages of the Path. How to give is the next topic. This is two parts, how not to give and how to give. First is how not to give. Cast aside these 13 ways of giving because they are to be eliminated. 1. Not giving right away but only after you have delayed. This is how not to give. 2. Giving under stress. 3. Giving after you have involved yourself in affairs that accord neither with the teachings nor with the ways of the world. 4. Making a commitment beforehand that I will give you this much, and later making a gift of reduced quality or amount. 5. Giving in return for favor. 6. Giving in installments when you could give all at one time. 7. As a ruler, giving away someone else's child or spouse that you have kidnapped. 8. taking through pleasure the belongings of your parents, servants, etc., and then giving them to others. 9. Making a gift by a method that will hurt someone else. 10. While you remain idle, employing someone else to do the giving for you. 11. Giving while you criticize and have contempt for the one who asks for something, while you are indirectly critical in a way that implies contempt, or while you intimidate the recipient with harsh words. 12. Giving while you violate the Buddha's prohibitive precepts. And 13. Not giving resources as you acquire them, but giving them after you accumulate them for a long time. Indeed, Bodhisattvas see that it is wrong to give resources that you have not stored up, whereas it is not wrong to give them away as you acquire them. This is because there is no additional merit in storing them up and then giving them at one time. And because you turn away many requests for your goods while you are storing them up, you come to feel tormented and may give them to someone who has not asked for them. This point stated in the Bodhisattva levels are very important, for you can see that during the period of storing of the goods that you produce many afflictions such as stinginess and the like, that the trouble of safeguarding them and so forth becomes a hindrance to many virtuous actions, and that more often than not you lose them at some point and are not able to give them away in the end anyway. Next is how to give. First of all, smile with a beaming countenance and then give to any recipient, showing respect by speaking honestly. Give with your own hands at the appropriate time without hurting anyone else and bearing the suffering of any hardship. The result of these actions is described in the chapter of the truth speaker. Vasubandhu's Treasury of Knowledge states that from giving charity with your own hands you get a vast amount of resources. And the Treasury of Knowledge auto commentary explains that stable resources means that others do not interfere with them and that fire, etc., does not destroy them. Furthermore, there is a way to help others to be generous. If you have some belongings, go to the homes of stingy people who have no experience of giving gifts even a few times. Joyfully and in a relaxed manner, direct them as follows. I really do own a vast amount of things. I want some people to ask me for things so that I can complete the perfection of generosity. So if you meet some people who ask for you for something, rather than turning them away without giving them anything, take from my wealth and give it to them, or else lead them to me and then rejoice in my generosity. This does not destroy their wealth, and they do this with pleasure. In this way, they plant the seed for the removal of their stinginess. By gradually getting used to doing this, they will give away a little of their own wealth and they will reduce their attachment a little. Contingent upon this, they will reach a moderate absence of attachment, and contingent upon that, a great absence of attachment. In like fashion, give belongings to your abbot, masters, students and friends who have a lot of attachment and are incapable of giving, and to those who are not like that but have no belongings, and then cause them to make offerings to the three jewels rather than doing it yourself. But by doing this, you produce a great deal of personal merit. It pacifies the afflictions of the some, fulfills the desire to practice the teachings in others, gathers beings around you and causes them to mature. Similarly, if you have no belongings, you may build a wealth through a craft or a job and then give it away. Or else you may tell others a religious story in which even the poor or miserly wish to give. Alternatively, send those reduced to begging to the houses of rich persons who have faith, and go there yourself to assist in the giving of gifts to the extent that you are able. Also, as you sort through the material goods for charity, give the better first and give away completely all the goods present for charity. Next is things to give, which has two parts. First is a brief presentation of the things which are and are not to be given. In brief, Bodhisattvas should give to others those things which immediately produce in the recipients pleasurable feelings that are free from the causes for a miserable rebirth, and which ultimately will benefit them, either eliminating their sun or setting them in virtue. Even if these things do not immediately bring happiness, they should give them if they are beneficial in the end. They should not give things which immediately produce pain and ultimately cause harm, or which are immediately pleasant but ultimately harmful. Detailed explanation of the things which are and are not to be given. This has two sections. The first is detailed explanation about inner things which are and are not to be given. Once you understand how not to give inner things, you will know the opposite of that, what you should give. Therefore, I will first explain how not to give. This has three parts. First is inappropriate giving from the viewpoint of time.